is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The partisan rhetoric in Washington is intensifying as new court filings suggest President Trump may have skirted campaign finance laws.
There's a very real prospect that he may be the first president in quite some time to face the real prospect of jail time.
If someone makes an error in filing paperwork or in not categorizing a campaign contribution correctly, it shouldn't be jail time. It ought to be a fine.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, and Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. Prosecutors are recommending prison time for two former members of President Trump's inner circle, and the president's current circle continues to break apart, with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, a Brighton native, planning to leave at the end of the year. And joining me now to sort through the latest Washington turmoil is my friend and former colleague Aaron Blake. He's a senior political reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post. Aaron, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's great to be on with you, Callum.
So let's start with the search for a new chief of staff. Nick Ayers, who's the chief of staff for Vice President Pence, was being considered for this role, but he turned it down and, like Kelly, will be leaving the White House at the end of the year. So if Kelly represented discipline as a Marine general, what does Trump's interest in Ayers tell us about the kind of person he's looking for, even if the pick won't be Ayers himself?
Well, I think it's the next person in line. He was the most obvious selection for that job, given that he's somebody who the president's worked with. He is somebody who has worked well, actually, with the president's son and son-in-law and daughter, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, which is not something that we could say about John Kelly. That was the source of a lot of the tension within the White House, was that he never really navigated the complex dynamics that have to do with the president employing his son-in-law and his daughter as senior advisors within the White House. And Ayers is just somebody who is, you know, very well regarded and has been around the block, has ties to both the establishment, but has also been willing to work in the Trump White House, which is not something you can say for a lot of people within Washington right now. And so the question we confront now is, who next? And there aren't a whole lot of conventional choices in line, and that's why we're seeing a lot of unconventional names being floated at this point.
For that job and for others, too, right? I mean, we've got other changes going on in the administration. We've got the president nominating William Barr to replace Jeff Sessions as attorney general and Heather Nauert to replace Nikki Haley as UN ambassador. And Aaron, these would at least seem to be very different kinds of picks. Barr has been the attorney general before under Bush 41, so his relevant experience is obvious. But meanwhile, Nauert is a spokeswoman for the State Department, and before that was the fourth cast member on Fox and Friends. So is there any unifying theme here?
In a word, no. I would say that William Barr is probably one of the more traditional picks that the president has made for his cabinet. But what we're seeing with a lot of these other positions is that it is becoming more and more difficult for the president to find people to fit in. You might think back to a few months ago when the president picked his personal doctor, Ronnie Jackson, to be the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, somebody with very little leadership experience, at least as far as a complex federal bureaucracy, who was put in the position of handling a very troubled institution within American government. Heather Nauert is very much an untraditional pick for the United Nations. I think it fits with Trump's attitude towards the UN in that he's more of a nationalist. He doesn't necessarily view these international alliances as being particularly worth his time or nominating somebody with lots of experience. But it's also a symptom, I think, of it's just going to get more and more difficult to find people to fill these jobs. A number of Trump cabinet secretaries have found themselves on the end of Trump missives once they leave, when they've been too honest about their experience there. A lot of them have found it just very difficult to work within him. I'm thinking, of course, about Gary Cohn as the National Council of Economic Advisors, Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State. A lot of these guys are and women are confronting situations in which they may really like the idea of being a cabinet secretary, but they've also seen how it can really go sideways on somebody because of the kind of leader that the president is. And I think that's making it much more difficult to recruit for some of these jobs.
And Bill Barr did write that notable op-ed last year defending the president's firing of James Comey as FBI director. So maybe the common thread between him and Nauert is defending him in the media. And the president is on the defensive, Aaron. You know, on Friday, we saw some major court filings related to the Trump, to the former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, and the president's former lawyer, Michael Cohen. And Aaron, you broke down five big takeaways from those filings for the Post. Could you give us one for each of them, maybe one for Manafort and one for Cohen?
Yeah, so I think the big finding with Cohen is that Robert Mueller, for whatever reason, seems very focused upon President Trump's efforts to build a Trump Tower Moscow. This was, of course, a focus of the plea for lying that Michael Cohen gave a couple weeks ago. But there was always a question of exactly why why Mueller was focusing on this particular lie when it's clear that Michael Cohen has told lots and lots of lies over the course of his talks with investigators. The most likely answer was that this was an event that was interesting for Robert Mueller for one reason or another. And I think that the documents this Friday reinforce that and suggest that Mueller sees this as an area of inquiry when it comes to potential collusion. In fact, if you look at the documents, there is an extensive rationale provided for exactly why this is an area of interest for him, which I thought was a very pregnant inclusion. As far as Paul Manafort goes, the interesting thing to me is that two of the five areas in which Robert Mueller's team says that he has been untruthful with them after striking his cooperation agreement have to do with a Ukrainian business associate named Konstantin Kalimnik, who the U.S. government has said, as of a few months ago, had ties to Russian intelligence as of 2016. That was, of course, a very conspicuous inclusion in that filing. So this suggests that there was lots of questioning about Kalimnik when Paul Manafort decided to cooperate, and it also suggested that Paul Manafort, for whatever reason, decided to lie about Konstantin Kalimnik. And I think the real question there is why he decided to lie about that particular set of circumstances, especially with somebody who is not going to see the inside of an American courtroom anytime soon and wouldn't seem to be in any legal jeopardy himself. So those are maybe the two most interesting takeaways that I had on Friday.
Interesting. And maybe we'll learn more in future filings. I'd like to bring in another person to the conversation here. Former federal judge Nancy Gertner is a regular on the show and a WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, you know, in the filings on Friday, we had some stuff, particularly with Michael Cohen, related to, you know, campaign year payments to the porn star Stormy Daniels. And, you know, they would seem to be getting kind of far afield, perhaps, from the original mandate of the special counsel to probe Russian interference in the election and possible coordination with the Trump campaign. So what did you see in Friday's filings that maybe get to that core mandate that Mueller had?
Well, I mean, I think that what happens in any investigation, and particularly this one, is that he begins to follow the money that led to Manafort on the one hand, Manafort's activities in the Ukraine and offshore accounts, and it, to some degree, it led to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, which is to say following what happened to monies, Trump monies during the campaign. It also is, you know, a classic prosecutorial technique. If you're investigating X and you come up with proof of Y, you don't say, whoops, that's not within my mandate. In this case, he basically passed that on to those who would be involved. So, you know, and it worked, right? I mean, Cohen understood the jeopardy that he was in and began to cooperate, not well, but cooperate.
So we have sentencings coming up here, Judge Gertner. We've got Michael Cohen this week on Wednesday, Manafort not until February. But what do you expect from those two?
Well, you know, one way to look at it is almost as if you look at this in terms of vectors. So the Cohen's brief on by his lawyers was suggesting no time and talked about his cooperation. And in a certain sense, they walked the plank because having said no time, it's very hard for them then to participate in a conversation about how much time. The government's brief, that's from the Southern District of New York, was really quite strong and angry about how Cohen had actually not meaningfully cooperated, that he had lied, and only when confronted with facts that showed that he had lied did he begin to turn around, that he had not done the kind of full debriefing that the Southern District expected. So they wanted something like 4 years, which is a minor reduction from the guideline sentence. The Mueller was interesting. Mueller couldn't say, oh, we want 2 years. They're part of the same government. So all Mueller said is essentially he did, you know, that Cohen was enormously helpful in talking about the lie to Congress, in talking about Russian contacts. And so he said as much as he could without coming up with a number, which would put one part of the government at war with the other part. What will happen, it seems to me, is that there will be an upward pressure to 4 years from the Southern District briefing, and there'll be a downward pressure from the special counsel's briefing. And the judge could well do something like 2 years, but that Cohen will get time, I think, is extremely likely. Let me say one other thing. Even if he gets sentenced to imprisonment now, if he cooperates over the course of the next year, the government can always file a motion asking the judge for a further reduction on the basis of his cooperation. So it's not over.
Judge Grittner, if Manafort and Cohen haven't been truthful with the special counsel's office, can we infer anything about the veracity of statements that the president might have made to the special counsel?
Well, that's the interesting. It's like unraveling a skein here. I mean, it goes in two directions. On the one hand, we know that Manafort was talking to the White House. We also know that Cohen was talking to the White House. And so the question is whether or not the president, in drafting the statement that he did, or having his counsel draft it, were relying on Manafort and Cohen's account. Because if he were, he may well have stepped into a false statement. You know, relying on, expecting that this is what the special counsel knows, and therefore I'll do the same thing. In addition, in the Cohen submissions, there was discussion of who helped Cohen prepare what Cohen said before Congress. And that's a very interesting and troubling skein, because it could lead to lawyers in the White House as well as Trump himself.
So, Aaron Blake, in the moments that we have left, you know, we heard Adam Schiff at the top talking about impeachment, and we've just heard Judge Grittner laying out some indications that could maybe point to obstruction or perhaps a charge of making false statements. But if there isn't sort of an underlying collusion crime here, will there be the political will with a divided Congress to actually move ahead with impeachment as a realistic possibility, Aaron?
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult no matter which the more severe verdict from Robert Mueller's team it is here, whether it's on the obstruction side or whether it's on the collusion side. But I think maybe an interesting kind of option C here right now, and one that we're confronting based upon Friday's documents, is the idea that if the president loses re-election in 2020 and he's out of office come January of 2021, does the Southern District of New York potentially bring charges against him for this campaign finance violation that has been proven based upon the Cohen plea deal? And as of Friday, the government now says, in its own words, is something that the president himself directed and told Cohen to do. The fact that they included that language in these documents Friday, I think, was a very conspicuous inclusion. Generally, that's what you do when you're about to charge somebody or thinking about it. Of course, they're not going to charge a sitting president because that's generally not how things are done. But this is a man who could be out of office within 2 years, and the statute of limitations would not have run out by then. So that's a compelling third option here that I think we all should be aware of.
There's a lot still left to play out.
The false statements here are false statements about Russia. And in the Cohen filing, the special counsel was very clear to talk about contacts with Russia that were going on exactly at the same time as the hacking. So I don't think we've seen the end of that.
That is former federal judge Nancy Grittner, WBUR legal analyst, and Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Callum.
Stay with us.
Thanks.
There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.